My name is Bill Still, and I live just outside of Washington, D.C. in the Virginia suburbs, and my new film is called The Secret of Oz. It's the sequel to The Money Masters. I've been looking for a way to tell the monetary reform story in shorter fashion ever since I produced The Money Masters, which was released in 1996, because it comes in at 3 hours and 23 minutes, and that's really just too long for most people to sit through the story. So I've always been looking for a new way to do it. And when I discovered the wonderful Wizard of Oz connection, in other words, the original book version, and how that was laden with monetary reform symbolism, I immediately jumped on it. I was surprised that I hadn't heard it before, but it's been a topic of a professional paper writing in the economics community for nearly 2 decades. And so as soon as I saw that, you know, there was legit research behind it, I jumped right on it and made a new film, which comes in at a little over 100 minutes, which is much more consumable for the average person.
Can you tell us about the various symbols then in The Wizard of Oz that you believe actually have some sort of monetary significance and how they relate to the characters, for example?
Well, the most important symbolism was destroyed when the 1939 movie was made, and so that's why we really don't know about that. When the 39 movie was made by MGM with Dorothy and the ruby slippers, it was actually the ruby slippers that were the culprit. They changed the original color of the slippers was silver, and that brought forth the symbolism of the silver slippers on the gold road. And what that meant was silver at that point was a from-the-bottom-up alternative to increasing the money supply, whereas the bankers had a gold-only money system that they could control quite completely and impoverish people in general, and thereby cause the deepest and the most lengthy depression in American history, the post-Civil War depression, because they were able to keep silver out of the money supply and make it a gold-only system.
So you're saying the yellow brick road really was the gold brick road?
Yes. In the book version, the yellow brick road was not a good thing. It was a dangerous road that could only be traversed when Dorothy had on the magical silver slippers. And of course, that was at any point she could escape from her travails by clicking the heels of her silver slippers together 3 times. And what that meant was that America, unbeknownst to most of the population, could escape the depression merely by adding additional money to the system, just like you in your own personal life. You can escape your financial travails if someone stuck a bunch of extra money in your pocket. Of course, we can do that, and we can do it without debt, and that is the problem right now. Our system is entirely not only laden with debt, but based on debt, and we can never get out of debt because of that, and that's why all these austerity measures that are currently being enforced on Britain will absolutely never work, because the debt and the interest caused by the debt is way too big, and the austerity that you can actually cut out of a system is way too small, and so eventually this system will still collapse.
But haven't we been running debt for decades, if not hundreds of years?
Yes, absolutely. But the system has now reached something that economists are calling for the first time debt saturation, where the interest on the debt has just become so huge. For example, in the United States, I don't know the British situation, but in the United States, the interest paid on the debt is greater than the total discretionary spending of the United States Congress every year. In other words, all the stuff that we argue about, oh, we're spending too much money on bridges to nowhere, blah, 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 you may have heard. All of that is exceeded by the interest we pay mostly to bankers on our money, the interest on the national debt, a totally unnecessary expenditure. We don't have to do it that way. We don't have to have our money based on debt. And a nation, the thing that makes a sovereign nation sovereign is that it can create its own money without debt. It's a scam that bankers essentially have perpetrated on us that we don't need and is now killing the system, and it's killing it worldwide.
So how does that relate to the silver slippers and the gold brick road in The Wizard of Oz?
Because at that point, silver could not be controlled because it was being mined so prodigiously in the western United States. And so it was an addition to the money supply that was outside of the control of the bankers. Now, of course, the addition of silver money would not do anything because silver is now traded electronically by high-frequency trading, etc. It's no different from anything else. The only thing that will relieve us from our problem right now is to stop issuing our money a debt, stop government borrowing, stop this tremendous debt-based economy.
You can't stop government borrowing, surely, because they won't have any money to spend.
No, you absolutely can. Those are the two great pillars upon which monetary reform is absolutely based. No more government borrowing. The thing that makes a nation sovereign is that it does not borrow it, its money. It creates it without debt.
So what you're saying is essentially that, similar to what quite a lot of other economists have been saying in Britain, is that what we need to be doing is this printing of money or quantitative easing, only making sure that that money is used directly by the government and spent into the economy rather than given to the banks as it is at the moment.
Absolutely. A nation does not have to borrow its money into existence. That is the essence of what makes a nation a sovereign nation. The borrower shall be servant to the lender. Why, if you want to call your nation sovereign, would you want to indebt it to bankers? No, because if you're indebting it to bankers, then bankers, by definition, will use that money to buy into the political system and thereby control the political system. There's a word for that in political science. It's called plutocracy, not democracy.
Rule by the rich.
Rule by the rich. That's correct. That's what we have now. You have a plutocratic system disguised as a democratic system.
What about some of the other symbolism in The Wizard of Oz then? The scarecrow, the tin man, the lion. Do they have any kind of significance for the monetary reformers or not?
Well, yeah, it all told the monetary reform story. You know, the scarecrow represented the Midwestern farmers who were hit hardest by the depression of the post-Civil War depression, and they were thought to be brainless. But the secret of money is not that difficult once you understand it. And so the scarecrow actually ended up ruling Oz in the book. Not that he was the smartest one, but, you know, anyone with half a brain, once you understand the secret of Oz, can understand what the problem is and fix it.
Okay, what about the lion and the tin man then?
Well, the lion represented William Jennings Bryan. Of course, Bryan just coincidentally happens to rhyme with lion. Bryan was the greatest orator of his time and the greatest proponent of monetary reform of his time. And when he was defeated in the 1896 presidential election, then L. Frank Baum, who wrote the book version, The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, saw that monetary reform was dead, that the bankers had won. And so to me, he wrote The Wonderful Wizard of Oz just like he was firing a flare up into the night sky of history, hoping that someone down the road would pick up on these symbols and recover the monetary reform thought. And that's what we've done.
And the Tin Man?
The Tin Man represented the industrial worker, and there are a lot of symbols like that, and I kind of touch on them, but really the essence is the monetary reform platform.
So fundamentally, there's a problem with banking, and that is that bankers lend out money that they don't actually have. How did that come about historically?
It's a great gig if you can get it. If you or I actually lent money at interest that we didn't have, I believe that's called counterfeiting or fraud or both, and we'd be immediately thrown into jail. But when you're a banker and you can do it, you can get away with it. And of course, it's in the banker's interest to try to keep the politicians from making that a crime. And that's exactly what they've been able to successfully do. So we have a two-pronged problem. That is, we have nations borrowing money. That's a problem that has to be fixed. And we have banks lending money that they don't actually have. If you fixed those two problems, then you fix the economic system. And nothing else will fix the economic system. Until we address those problems, this is going to go nowhere but down, I can assure you.
Now, if you go back 1,000 years, the only kinds of money that were around were gold. And then over the years, the bankers, goldsmiths, started to use pieces of paper to represent the gold because paper was more convenient. It wasn't really heavy. They were keeping the people's deposits in gold, but then they could trade that gold using those bits of paper. How did the bankers then start issuing actually more bits of paper than they had gold in their coffers?
They just did it. It was a fraud. The temptation is way too great. If you have a gold repository and you're issuing pieces of paper to represent the gold, it's way too easy, especially if you're loaning out these pieces of paper and getting interest back, it's way too easy to overissue pieces of paper because it's in your financial interest to do it. And the problem was that back in 1100 AD, King Henry, the son of William the Conqueror, was the first one to actually do something about this scam. And he decided that the goldsmiths, by either lending out their pieces of paper liberally or refusing to lend them out, could affect the entire national economy. They could cause boom times, good times, by lending out liberally, throwing more money into the economy, or they could cause depressions by contracting that money supply. And the problem with it was that thereby they controlled the politics of the nation. They could go into the king and say, look, we don't like this policy that you're doing. If you continue, we're going to cause a depression. Because they had discovered that the goldsmiths never got the blame for the depression. They could always push the blame off on the sovereign or the politician. And so thereby they controlled the politics of the nation. So that's why King Henry invented tally sticks, which was basically the form of money upon which the British Empire was built for some 700 years. And that broke the back of the goldsmiths, put more money into the hands of the common person, and took it away, the money power, away from the bankers. And this is what led to the empowering of the middle class that brought on the whole rise of the arts, etc. in Britain. And it was a good thing.
What is a tally stick?
A tally stick was basically just a stick of hazelwood that was polished and split down the middle. Notches were cut into the stick before it was split, and then when it was split, you had two halves that were identical, that when they were put back together, it was impossible to counterfeit, in other words, and the king kept one half and spent the other half into the economy, paid for things. And how do you pay for things with a stick?
Yeah, good question. How do you?
Well, it's very simple. You declare the tally stick to be good for the payment of taxes. And so there's a built-in demand for the tally stick. Well, we've got to get some of those tally sticks because that's the only thing we can pay our taxes with. And so it circulated as money. And it was money without debt created strictly by the government for the benefit of all people equally in the public interest. That's what money should be. That's the most important thing that should be in the public interest, the issuance of money.
So, for example, people in Bristol here running things like Let's schemes, creating these little local currencies, if those local currencies were good for the payment of local taxes, then they would actually be, in a way, a kind of parallel system, and they would be picked up and used more, do you think?
Yes, that's right. Competing currencies is probably a good way to go.
Going back to the Bank of England then, what role has the Bank of England played in all this? Because I think many people are a bit puzzled when they see the Queen's head on banknotes and coins. To what extent is this actually controlled by the government and by our politicians, our elected politicians, and to what extent is it actually controlled by the city?
The formation of the Bank of England was originally the thing that started to bring down the tally stick system and bring back the system of government indebtedness. 1694, I believe, 1696, I forget the exact date. But in any case, within 50 years, government borrowing through the Bank of England system had risen to such an extent that 75% of British taxes went just to paying interest on this new national debt. That's money totally siphoned out of the economy, siphoned into the hands of the bankers, thereby empowering the bankers both financially, and they use that money in turn to get politicians elected, so it perpetuates the system, and that's the system we have today.
Also, what about the role of the Rothschild family?
Yes, the Rothschilds were very important in the creation of this fractional reserve lending system and the domination of banks lending money to governments.
So what is fractional reserve then?
No, a fractional reserve is where banks get to lend money they don't actually have. And theoretically, in the United States, they've been held to a 10% reserve requirement. In other words, they can lend out $9 for every $1 that they hold in reserves. However, we found out with the crash in 2008 that no one had been adhering to that reserve requirement. The big banks were leveraged 50-1. Freddie and Fannie were leveraged 72-1. Goldman Sachs, the big investment bank, was leveraged 333-1.
So they were lending out £300 for every £1 that they had in deposit. Now, that does sound like fraud, doesn't it?
Oh, of course it's fraud. It's fraud of the worst kind because it robs you and I every second that they do it. It's sucking money out of the economy, consolidating it into the hands of these big bankers for their own use.
But
and, of course, they use that money to perpetuate themselves politically.
But surely they're actually creating lots of money and spending that into the economy, which is a good thing.
Oh, well, it may be a good thing except for one little thing, and that's they're doing it at interest. And they're skimming off the interest. And that's not the system we need. We can return that functionality to the government itself, where they can issue all the money they want without debt in the public interest. That's the system we should have. That's the system we don't have. The system we do have is one that's disguised to be the right system. That's why all these national central banks are called Bank of England, Bank of France, etc., the Federal Reserve System, to give them the concept that this is your national bank, where issuing the money in the national interest. And that's why if you ask the average person on the street in the United States who issues the money, they'll think it's a trick question. But when they finally get around to answering, they'll say, well, it's the government. That's what it's supposed to make you think is happening. But it's not the government that's issuing the money. It's the big banks. And the Fed is just there to make it appear that they're controlling the big banks, but they really aren't.
So how did Nathan Rothschild make so much money at the Battle of Waterloo, out of the battle?
By communications. He was able to use his money to get news of the victor at the battle before anyone else, and so he was able to play the stock market appropriately and win big.
So where do you see the present economic crisis going? As someone that's studied money for quite a while now, Bill.
It's going to, their job is merely to decrease the slope of the spiral downwards so that hopefully we don't get too agitated about it. They can't stop it at this point. The interest on the debt is siphoning off way too large a percentage. And so it's going to do nothing to spiral in downwards until we're none of us have jobs and we're all serfs and it's totally dependent on government for everything.
So do you think that the bankers really have now more power than governments do?
Absolutely. Just look where all of the so-called stimulus money in the United States went. It went almost completely to bankers.
So why doesn't that money then find its way into the economy? How do the bankers manage to convince the politicians this is a good thing to do?
Well, the politicians are just like you and I. We're all leveraged out to the maximum in loans. And if those loans are not rolled over, then we're in trouble, just like most of the large commercial media in the United States. They're totally in the thrall under the control of the bankers because they owe so much money to them. The bankers can shut them down in a second. So, of course, they can't talk about topics like this.
What about, because you've got the famous gold depository of Fort Knox in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Surely that's really what underpins the U.S. economy, isn't it?
No. It has nothing to do with it at this point. And in fact, there's probably no gold left in Fort Knox. There's certainly no good deposit gold, 995 gold. If they had any, they would certainly show it. The U.S. government requires that an annual physical audit be done on the gold reserves in Fort Knox, where the largest percentage of world gold in the history of the world was collected at the end of World War II. Some 72% of world gold was deposited in Fort Knox. So, of course, you want to have some type of controls over the world's greatest treasure, and that control was the Congress required an annual physical audit. Well, guess what? There's not been a physical audit of the gold reserves in Fort Knox done since 1957. That's over 50 years. A totally unaudited supply, and yet the U.S. government still carries a vast quantity of gold bullion on its books, claiming that it's still in Fort Knox when it indeed is not. I've written over 20 books, but I'm just not pushing any of that stuff right now. You know, they're on a variety of different topics. Being a writer all my life, I've written on books on medicine and all different topics. But the only thing I'm interested in pushing is the new film. That's to be found at www.secretofoz.com.